diversos postos da Aliança Rebelde, que está começando mais um Desnazificando, o seu podcast quinzenal realizado pelas coordenadoras do NEPAT, o Núcleo Brasileiro de Estudos de Nazismo e Holocausto. Aqui quem fala é a Ana Viana, e no episódio de hoje nós vamos disponibilizar para vocês o conteúdo que nós preparamos para o evento internacional Lessons and Legacies Regional Meeting Sydney. Pois é, para quem não está sabendo, eu, Bárbara e Maria fomos virtualmente até a Austrália para poder falar sobre o nosso projeto de divulgação científica, tanto aqui nos Desnazificando quanto nas redes sociais do NEPAT. Nós criamos uma mesa redonda chamada Mediating the Holocaust on Social Media, The Experience of the Brazilian Center for Nazism and Holocaust Studies, para falar sobre os desafios e sobre as potencialidades do nosso trabalho. Então, nós abordamos a nossa experiência como pesquisadoras brasileiras, o nosso método de trabalho, a história pública, os desafios encontrados ao tentar criar conteúdo para as redes sociais e para o podcast, entre outros assuntos que dizem respeito ao nosso trabalho. E a nossa ideia foi justamente levar essas inquietações e vivências para as terras gringas e trocar experiências com outros pesquisadores e com outras pessoas que trabalham com as mídias sociais. Então, com perdão dos possíveis erros de inglês, a gente espera que vocês aproveitem o conteúdo mesmo assim. Vamos lá?
So this roundtable is on mediating the Holocaust on social media, which sounds really interesting and timely, considering also Lynn Schwartz's presentation yesterday. And our guests will be discussing the experience of the Brazilian Center for Nazism and Holocaust Studies. So I will just very briefly introduce our three speakers or panelists, and then they will do more of the introduction and discussion themselves, and they will also explain the way how they plan to do the roundtable. So first of all, I'm going according to the abstract that you submitted. Is Maria Visconti as a historian in the final year of her PhD in history at the Federal University of Minas Gerais, I hope I pronounce it correctly, in Brazil. Maria also has a master's degree in history from the same institution, and she's one of the coordinators of this Brazilian Center for Nazism and Holocaust Studies, which, as I can read here, is an independent female-led initiative of history students at the university. The second speaker is Barbara Diotti, who is also a historian from the same institution where she majored in history and a teaching degree in the Federal University of Minas Gerais. And she was a member of the first class of the history branch of the pedagogical residency project awarded with a CAPES scholarship 2 years ago. And the final speaker, who I believe will be chairing the session, is Ana Carolina Alves Viana, is also a master's student in history and political cultures and has a degree in history, and also is one of the coordinators of this Brazilian Center for Nazism and Holocaust. Now, really glad to have you here, and we're looking forward to your discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, Jan, for that introduction. Good morning, everyone. Also, good evening to anyone who's watching from Brazil. As Jan said, my name is Bárbara Diotti. I graduated in history from the Federal University of Minas Gerais, and I will be the mediator of this roundtable where we will talk about the experience of the Brazilian Center for Nazism and Holocaust Studies, NEPAT. It's a great pleasure to be here at the Sydney Regional Meeting of the Lessons and Legacies Conference. First of all, on behalf of my colleagues and me, I'd like to thank the Sydney Lessons and Legacies Organizing Committee. So Ava Alba, who's here with us, Ruth Valent, and also you, Jan. I'd also like to thank the Holocaust Educational Foundation of Northwestern University and the University of New South Wales for hosting this event. And last but not least, I'd like to thank Professor Sarah Cushman from Northwestern University, who encouraged us to submit a proposal and be here today. This is our first participation in a foreign conference, and Anna and I will also be presenting in English for the first time. So we are very excited to be here and talking about our work at NEPAT. So before I introduce the topics for today's debate, I would like to briefly introduce Nefach, since our experience in the group is the topic of today's discussion. And I believe many people don't know our work internationally. Well, as I said, NEPACH is the Brazilian Center for Nazism and Holocaust Studies. We are an independent student initiative of history students from all academic levels from the Federal University of Minas Gerais. The center has always been a female-led initiative, and our group was founded and led only by women. We are currently run by three coordinators, Ana and Maria, my colleagues and I. And as I mentioned, we are an independent initiative, which means we do not have any funding, we do not work for profit, so we do all of our work for free. And NEPACH, this group, arose from the need to create more spaces for academic dialogue in Brazil on the fields of Nazism and the Holocaust. Because unfortunately, these fields of study are still not very consolidated here in Brazil, and Brazilian historians face constant challenges in conducting their research due to a lack of investment, funding, and general opportunities. Mm-hmm. So one of our goals is to make research exchanges easier and to encourage Brazilian scholars who studied the Nazi regime, who studied the Holocaust and related fields. In addition to that, we also observed a growing demand from the general public for quality historical content about these topics. They undoubtedly arise so much interest. So since 2019, NEPACH has been working on two fronts, academic production and scientific divulgation. In the academic field, we organize academic events. We also coordinate an interdisciplinary association of studies, Thinking the Extremes, the International Studies Association of Nazism, Memory and War. We also have a few partnerships with other institutes and organizations, both nationally and internationally. For example, the Holocaust Museum of Curitiba here in Brazil, the first and only Holocaust Museum here in Brazil, but also the British Association of Holocaust Studies, the Perpetrator Studies Network of Utrecht University, and of course, the Holocaust Educational Foundation of Northwestern. So these are a few institutions that we exchange academic knowledge with and stay in touch with. And of course, in our scientific divulgation project, which is also very important for us, we work with the production of content for our social media, following the propositions of public history, because we believe that disseminating knowledge in a committed and ethical manner may be a way to help construct a more democratic society. So that is our main goal. That is something that we believe in. And very briefly, that is the work that NEPACH does. So I think I would like to first, ask my colleagues, Maria and Ana, to briefly talk a little bit about their research before we start the discussion. I think that would be interesting. So, Ana, you can go first, please. The floor is yours.
So, hello, everyone. Good morning and good evening. It's a pleasure to be here today with all of you, and thank you for having us. So, well, I'm Ana. I am a master's student, as Jan already said, and I research mainly the work and the life of Alfred Rosenberg, who is known commonly as chief ideologist of the Nazi regime. And my primary source in this research is the myth of the 20th century. And what I am attempting to do is to analyze the writing of history, the uses of the past, and the temporalities in his specific work at the myth.
Thank you, Ana. Maria, why don't you tell us a little bit about your PhD?
Yes, so thank you so much for having us here. Like everyone already said, I'm Maria. I'm the final year of my PhD, so I am at the moment where I should be writing my thesis, although I am not, but I should be. And my research is about the Nazi perpetrators during the Nuremberg trial. I try to develop a set of archetypes of the ways the Nazis behaved and how they evaded responsibility during this trial in Nuremberg. And my main goal is for these archetypes can serve as a basis for us to better understand similar perpetrator narratives and other trials. So that's mainly what I have been doing.
Thank you, Maria. So let's start the debate. I'm going to pose a few questions for Anna and Maria to discuss. And one of the first topics that I would like to introduce today is your experience as Brazilian researchers. You come from a country where there is no consolidated Holocaust studies field. As I said, of course, there are academics who study this topic, but the field is not comparable to what the areas like in Europe and other countries like the United States, for example. One indicator of this is the fact that there is only one institution dedicated to the memory of the Holocaust in Brazil, which is the Holocaust Museum of Curitiba. So we come from a country where there is no established memory culture surrounding the Holocaust, which is not surprising at all, considering how Brazil suppresses the memory of its own traumatic past. And of course, Brazil is a so-called developing country or third world country. So which means that you are studying European history from a position of coloniality. So the first question I would like to ask is, can you talk more about these unique challenges that you face as Brazilian researchers? And what are some of the experiences of overcoming or dealing with these challenges?
So to start this conversation, I think it's very important to point out, like Barbara already said, the lack of studies about the Nazi regime, which is very interesting because even though several Nazis fled to Latin America to escape justice after the Third Reich, and Brazil was the destination of some important figures such as Joseph Mengele or Franz Stengel, it is still not a country that traditionally researched the Nazi regime. And of course, that leads to an absence of literature in Portuguese about this research field. And historians have few possibilities for conducting proper research because of that. And also, like Barbara already said, due to lack of investment, funding, and also research opportunities. But even with those limitations, of course, we have relevant works in this area. There are some Brazilian scholars who are worth mentioning today. There are Bruno Leal, Thais Campelo, Ana Maria Dietrich, Felipe Abau, Luiz Edmundo de Souza, René Gertz, Maria Luisa Tucci Carneiro. Some of those scholars gave lectures to the international online event that we held this year in April. NEPAD held an international event, which actually also had a conference by Wendy Lauer that was also in here in Lessons and Legacies, I believe. And all the videos from this international event we held are available on our YouTube channel. So I believe you can insert English automatic subtitles. So maybe you can learn a little bit more about how the Brazilian scholars are addressing this theme. But when looking into other Latin countries that were also profoundly influenced by the Nazi regime, we can see that unfortunately Brazil stands alone with this lack of research on this topic. For instance, we can mention Argentina and Chile, also from South America, who have researched their authoritarian regime's relationship with the Nazis for many years now. However, we have been making significant steps in changing Brazil's presence in the international Holocaust studies scenario. For instance, there was the recent creation in 2020, last year, of the Latin America Network for Shoah Studies, La Rede Latinoamérica para la Enseñanza de la Shoah, that shows that not only Brazil, but also other Latin countries are increasingly interested in understanding and transmitting Holocaust memory. And addition to that, in November of this year, I believe it was only last week, Brazil achieved also another essential step towards consolidating this project of learning the Holocaust and talking about anti-Semitism, because the country was officially incorporated as an observer member of the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance. That was just last week, I believe. And that was the result of course, the constant efforts of Brazilian scholars, ambassadors, government members, and again, the Holocaust Museum of Curitiba, which is one of our greatest partners here. And also, like Barbara briefly mentioned, it's important to talk about the significant problem that Brazil has with its own traumatic memory. We underwent a military dictatorship here for many years, but we did not deal with our perpetrators, even less with our victims, unlike, again, other Latin countries. For instance, we still have monuments and streets named after tortures even today, and we did a very inferior job, to say the least, in our transition to democracy at the end of the 1980s. So that brings us to an enormous problem with Brazil's transitional justice, and that impacts the way we see and act towards democracy even today. So it's not that big of a surprise that we are now facing a fascist authoritarian regime. It is merely an answer to the remains of the dictatorship in our minds and in our collective memory. Unfortunately, very unfortunately, Jair Bolsonaro, our president, it is a product of our time and our past, but that's something, unfortunately, again, we'll be talking further today.
Yeah, well, the context is indeed very, very difficult, as Maria just said, but to answer another aspect of Barbara's question, I would like just to very quickly highlight that in order to face those challenges, or at least try to deal with them, we believe that it's important to make an effort to understand what made this context possible and try to dialogue about that and about the surrounding matters that come with it with different people around us, which is something that we'll to approach further. So, but it's with that in mind that Nepache started to act on social networks to carry out a work of scientific divulgation guided by the proposal of public history. So we believe that this methodological outlook might not directly solve all of the problems that we're facing, but we truly believe that by working with it, we may explore differently history's potential to analyze, to question, and to make sense of the world crazy that is around us by contributing to building a more democratic and critical society. So that's one of the ways we found to try to deal with all of this craziness that we're living here.
Yes, thank you, Anna and Maria, for your answers. I think both of you definitely made some very important points surrounding the present political context here in Brazil. But if I may just introduce myself briefly into the conversation, even though I'm the mediator, I think a very important aspect of being a Brazilian scholar who was studying European history is the resistance that we often encounter from other people when we mention what we study. For example, we constantly hear suggestions about how we should be studying the Nazi Party in Brazil, or how we should study the participation of the Brazilian army in the Second World War, or that we should study the Holocaust survivors who fled to Brazil, or the Nazis who came here to escape justice. And of course, I'm not trying to say that those topics aren't important. They are, of course, but it is very limiting when we can only study European history if it relates back to Brazil. And I really feel like these kinds of questions or comments that we receive, for example, US American scholars or Canadian scholars who study the same topics, they don't usually receive these kinds of questions. So I feel like there is this limitation that is placed upon us that is very odd. And I think that's part of what it means to try and study a topic such as the Nazi regime or the Holocaust as Brazilian scholars. Yes. So I felt like I just had to make that comment.
Yeah, if I may, I would just like to quickly comment on something you just said, Barbara, because we indeed sense that sometimes people might think that we wouldn't be able to be studying anything we want, perhaps due to our urgence, for example, like there was like this limited scope of things that we could be doing. And I just wanted to highlight that I completely agree with this analysis you just made. And I also would like to add that I truly believe that different people from different places is precisely what kind of enriches our experience, right? So all of those people are able to study multiple objects, and that multiplicity is precisely what makes our experience broader and more interesting, I believe. So people with different historical baggages may, and I think that they certainly will have different perceptions about a certain historical theme. And that is precisely what will provide a deeper and more complete understanding of a certain historical theme or time or anything. So I would just like to say that, because I think that is truly something very important and that we should keep that in mind, you know. So I really agree with what you just said.
Thank you. Would either of you like to make any further comments before we move on to the next question? Very well. So as Anna mentioned in her answer, Nepat works with public history as a methodological outlook. And this branch of scientific divulgation that the group does is part of that. So I'd like to ask two related questions. First, what is Nepat's methodological approach to conducting this scientific divulgation project? And second, what are some of the commitments required of historians who do this kind of work, especially when it is related to talking about traumatic pasts? What are the ethical commitments that are involved in conducting such a project?
Okay, so if I may start, that's okay. So yeah, those are two central aspects of our works, right? So in Apache, as we already mentioned here quickly, we mainly work with the methodological proposal of public history. So firstly, I think that it's important to point out that public history was born in the US as an attempt to expand the operational field for historians. So in a moment in which employment was scarce, new possibilities of activities were conceived, such as consulting for companies, marketing education, general historical communication, among others. And in all of these perspectives, the main goal was precisely talking about history for a non-academic audience. And well, we definitely agree with the idea that historians have a lot to say to the public debate in order to contribute to a more critical society. However, as Brazilian historians Bruno Leal, which Maria just already mentioned here, and Ana Paula Teixeira signalized, here in Brazil, the rise of public history was not only related to a hard economic moment, although we definitely are still in one. I mean, public history gained a large significance recently due to the overwhelming growth of dilemmas that Brazilian society is facing, such as the anti-intellectualism, the anti-scientificism, the conspiracies, the direct attacks to the academic environment and to Brazilian universities, the public defense of multiple prejudices, of excluding discourses, and of the military dictatorship, which is a theme that you two already brought up here. And well, last but not least, of Holocaust denial. So it became clear for us that fighting all of these discourses was and is extremely urgent. And public history may not have a direct answer for all of these discourses and for all the challenges that we are facing, but we think that it offers us paths to communicate our historical knowledge broadly and, well, at least try to fight these hate speeches in the public space. So through social networks such as Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, we joined forces with our graphic designer to build an interesting and flashy profile to communicate what we know and to build a dialogue with the public so that we can also listen to their demands and try to solve some of the doubts and questions that they might have. And with that in mind, I think that it's important to point out that we agree with the definition by historian Ricardo Santiago, in which he points out that public history has four fundamental dimensions. It encompasses a history that is made for the public in the sense of expanding its audiences, with the public that it's collaborative and that has shared authority as a fundamental dimension, by the public, which incorporates non-institutional forms of history and memory, and that is concerned with the relationship between history and public, a dimension that would encompass the field's reflexivity and self-reflexivity in its interactions with the audience. So we emphasize here that the purpose of our work in Apache is not to transmit the knowledge created in academia to a non-academic audience in a passive way, but rather to build dialogues, to listen to demands, and to understand the multiple historical narratives that go beyond historiography and that contributes to shaping knowledge about history in our society. So, well, to wrap up, I think that it's important to highlight that we agree with Santiago when he states that research is a social activity that becomes complete only when communicated and placed in contact with the public. So that is precisely what we're trying to do on our social networks. That's precisely what we're trying to do here at NEPACHE.
I think it's also important to talk about our work as historians at his point, because the internet, of course, affected the way people connect with history and, of course, connected with everything. It subverted the basis for the production and for the circulation of narratives about the past. And digital platforms such as blog or social media, like Instagram and anything, allow anyone with internet access to convey their understandings of the past. And that has the potential to reach hundreds or millions or thousands of millions and billions of people. And for history, this means that the well-established and very ancient distinction between historians as producers of historiography and even producers of the past sometimes, and ordinary people as consumers of history is becoming increasingly blurred and more flexible. And so the rules about who has the power and the legitimacy to talk about the past have changed. And as historians, we must think about this scenario and what this means for us and for our profession. So if narratives about the past are being produced without us, we should ask ourselves how we can participate in this process. I mean, how can we take the lead in writing history in public spaces? And how should we use the tools provided by the internet to dialogue with the public in a way that is more effectively? And by staying away from the public sphere, we believe that historians lose or risk losing our social relevance, and the public is deprived of a richer understanding of the past that could come from us, from our contributions. So it seems more productive to seek a shared interpretation of the past, built in collaboration between historians and the public and the audience. So we can act in ways to guide, to complement, and to inform the narratives, contributing with our professional knowledge to a more critical understanding of the past, especially a traumatic past such as the Holocaust. So for us, the key is to occupy virtual public spaces and not avoid it, establish a dialogue with the public. And another thing that it's important to mention in this aspect is that if we want to share academic historical knowledge with the general public, we need to adapt our communication, because most people don't have the background knowledge that we specialists have. However, the importance of proper scientific dissemination is discredited by many within the academic world. Scientific divulgation sometimes is considered a copy and paste job, which brings information to the public in a very irresponsible way. And of course, that is true with some people and in some scenarios, but for us, that is not true. I mean, for us, scientific divulgation must be recognized as an intellectual production, which requires thought and interpretive decisions, just like any other academic production. Because after all, when we are writing something for an article or for a conference or for a roundtable, our language and our communication also needs to be adapted. So this work in editing what we're saying and how we're saying and the aspects we choose to talk about and we choose to analyze is something that we commonly do as historians. So that's not very, very different. But I believe that we are making some progress in this aspect because of the constant growth of the field of digital history. We have been seeing this field not only in academic productions, but also in academic events, congresses and things like that. And we recently read an academic article about the use of hashtags and the relationship of the hashtags with the public experience in the Auschwitz Memorial Museum. So that's something that is worth keeping an eye on, because I believe it's a path that's helpful for us as historians.
Thank you, Maria. Thank you, Anna. I'd just like to quickly mention that one of the articles that really influenced us about public history was Meg Foster's, and she's an Australian scholar, so that's nice. I just thought to mention that. I think both of you have made it very clear, and you both talked about public history very well, that this scientific divulgation project of NEPADS is obviously not done mindlessly. There is a lot of thought. There is a theoretical background behind it. And that's very important to discuss, but I would like to bring another aspect of scientific divulgation, especially on social media, to the table, let's say. So let's talk about some of the technical aspects of doing scientific divulgation on social media. So NEPADS mainly works on Instagram and with a podcast. These are the two main vehicles that the group uses to connect with this audience. So let's discuss the technical aspects of using these platforms. So a few of the questions I'd like to introduce for our discussion now is, what resources do these platforms offer? Why did NEPADS choose to work with them? And how is producing content on Instagram, for instance, different to producing a podcast? And also, finally, how does the group manage this cross-platform work?
So that's mainly the part that I like talking most. So talking about the platforms now, Instagram was chosen mainly because it is a platform where we can combine a good amount of text and images, and it is also a social network that it's appropriated for us to conduct this direct interaction with the audience, as Anna already said. But we also have a podcast, and we think that the podcast format is a very good complement to the Instagram production, because we can add more depth to the themes that we have talked on Instagram, because we can talk for more time, you know. So I'm gonna, in our Instagram profile, we have different types of posts. So I'm gonna just show you our Instagram profile just a second here. Okay, so you're seeing, right? Yes. So this is our Instagram profile right now. And we produce different kinds of posts each month. So to start, I'm going to just show you what we called concepts posts. For instance, this one, which are concepts that we think are important to understand the field of Nazism and Holocaust and other studies that are relevant to understanding the spirits, based on an analysis given by proper literature and proper bibliography. So for instance, here we have the concept of consent and coercion coined by historian Richard Evans. So as you can see, it has this color here, and the posts are mainly like this. So like I said, a combination of image and texts. But we also think that something that's very important and that the public generally likes a lot is the indication posts. In them, it's more possible for them to integrate different narratives about the Holocaust and about the Nazi regime in multiple platforms for history and memory. So we indicate mainly audiovisual materials such as movies. So here we have this movie, Denial, which is about Deborah Lipstadt and David Irving, the trial and the Holocaust denial. So as you can see, it has a different color here because it's an audiovisual indication. And, but also we indicate sometimes documentaries. For instance, this is The Accounted of Auschwitz. It's a documentary that was released in Netflix a few years ago. So it's the same color as you can see. But we also indicate literature, not only academic books, but also fiction books. So here we have, for instance, the indication of this book by Richard Evans, The Third Reich in History and Memory. I'm talking about Richard Evans a lot because we just made a thematic week because it was his birthday, I believe, last month or 2 months ago. So we made a thematic week where we indicate more of his work because of this. So here it's an indication of this book. Also, we try to indicate books that are in Portuguese because it's better for our audience, but it's also very difficult to do that. But we also indicate fiction books. So here we have this one, All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Doerr. As you can see, it's blue, it's different color. So it's like this. And at last, we do our own historical calendar that, for instance, this is not a good example, I'm sorry. let me just show you this one, for instance. The historical calendar is relevant dates, or at least dates that we think are relevant, and to understand certain moments about the Nazi regime and the Holocaust and the 20th century, the Second World War, we talk about it a lot. And as you can see, this one is for 1st of October 1946, which was the 75-year anniversary of the end of the Nuremberg trial, and it is a different color again. And we also did a thematic month about this anniversary of the trial. So we did a lot of content about post-war trials and Nazi fugitives and things like that. So this is mainly our work on Instagram. Of course, we also do videos and reels, but we don't have time to go into this. But I would like now to show you the difference of this and our production in the podcast. So this is an example of a post of our podcast. This is an episode about Richard Evans and Holocaust denial, where we talked about his book on his role on the trial of Deborah Lipstadt trial. So as you can see, we indicated the movie and then we talked further about this on the podcast. And you can see here, we have the podcast brand. Our podcast is called Desnazificando, which in English would be something like denazifying. And it is a totally different platform with a totally different audience. And on our podcast, we can elaborate more the topics we discuss. As I don't think I mentioned, but our episodes are 1 hour, 1 hour 30 length, something like this. And as you can see, it's different, the brand, but it also communicates with Nepache's general visual identity. So it's different from the other ones, but not so different. For instance, this is another episode. As you can see, it has this tearing down thing here. So the brand here, the colors, they communicate together. And if you see, for instance, how the podcast profile looks like in our website, it is like this. So you see the colors here and the style is the same. But it is important for us to talk about the podcast because we do something there that is different, because we, at least half of the episodes we launch each season are made in collaboration with other researchers. And that means that we ask someone and they come to the episode in a format like an interview to talk about their work. So this episode here, for instance, was with another researcher to talk about the far right movement and its relation with the past, like the Middle Ages and things, the reference they do in like this. So I'm just gonna stop sharing my screen just so I can talk more calmly. So why is that important? Because we can show our audience that we don't know everything. Even though we researched the Nazi regime and the 20th century for a long time, I mean, I researched the Nazi regime for at least 10 years now, it does not mean that I can talk and that we can talk with depth about all of the topics covering this period. So that is a fulfillment of our mission, because we're bringing quality in content to our audience and not just simplifying the conversation so that people can understand. I mean, that's not our main goal. That's something we're going to talk further today. But by bringing other researchers, that is also very important for us because it touches in a significant aspect of our production because we give room for earlier researchers, especially young women, to be able to talk and to present their work. Because since NEPAT is composed by me, I am a PhD student, Anna is a master's student, Barbara just graduated, it's very powerful for us to keep this horizontal dialogue. As all academics know here, or I believe they should know, the academia is not very kind to people who are just starting their careers or who are in different levels of their careers. So bringing young researchers to the podcast is also very important for us because of this. But just to finish the topic of the brand and the style, I need to mention that, as you can see, obviously, the visual identity is very important for us. The creation of the brand, the design, the colors, the style, those are things that are very, very important to us. And that's something that the academia and the historian mostly overlook. And we believe that the marketing aspect and the visual identity really make a difference on our work. And that's something we can talk more today, but that's the first contact that people have. So I believe that's something is worth mentioning.
Well, for me, I would just like to quickly comment on something that Maria just pointed out. And I think, well, she spoke beautifully about it. I would never be able to speak so well. So I feel very contemplated. But well, yeah, I think that you touched upon a very important aspect of this work. That is, the visual part of what we do on social networks, especially, is the first aspect of the work that the audience has contact with. So if it is not interesting, people tend to don't look further into the content that we are offering. So it's really important that we do not underestimate this part of the work, although sometimes we're not really used to do with that. So it's important for us to seek ways to make it interesting for the people who are going to us and who are seeing what we're doing, because well, they truly see it first, right? And another interesting aspect that you mentioned is the difference between the audiences. So on the Instagram followers are not exactly the same audience we have on podcast. So what we mainly do is try to put these two fronts of actuation in dialogue so that people who know only one part of our work, but not all of it, feel free and invited to take a look at our other initiatives. So it's just a quick example, like Maria mentioned, when we do a thematic month or a thematic week on Instagram, we combine this theme in a podcast episode. So we explore that further a little bit on our podcast so that people can see the theme being discussed differently on these two aspects of what we're doing. So we just wanted to point that out.
Yes, thank you, Anna. Thank you, Maria. I think this discussion of the technical aspects is very interesting, but also very important. I mean, we can't know everything, right? But if historians are interested in doing this work that is focused on social media, obviously we need to stay informed about how these platforms work. And this is an aspect where interdisciplinary connections can really be so fruitful. So we work with a graphic designer, and that has really changed the visual brand of NEPAT, and that's very important. But to jump to the next question, Anna just finished her remark by commenting on the audience, and that is what I'd like to ask about now. So of course, NEPAT has this whole project. We are really trying to fulfill what we believe is our role, our social role as historians in the ways that we see fit. But ultimately, all of the work that the group is trying to do would be pointless because without an audience, without reaching an audience, the group's project would never achieve its full potential or even complete its purpose. So this can definitely be a very delicate thing to balance, and this is what I would like us to discuss now. So a few questions. How can we reach an audience effectively and build engagement while staying true to a purpose, and how to navigate the algorithm and current trends, trending topics, current events, and all of that without losing sight of what our real purpose is, without losing sight of all of the ethical commitments involved in running a scientific publication project.
If I may start, I mean, to answer Barbara's question, I think it's very important to mention the difficulties we have within the platforms itself. I mean, when thinking about reaching an audience and building engagements, we also have to consider how the platform works, because every platform is different and the interaction with the content is also very different. For instance, we work mainly on Instagram and our podcast, but we also have a Facebook profile and a Twitter profile and a Twitch profile and a YouTube channel. And in LinkedIn page and everything you can think we have, but they are very different. I mean, I can't expect to have the exact same content of Instagram to work the exact same way if I put it on Twitter. That's something actually we did one time and it didn't work very well. So you have to think how the platform works in order to build this content and make it more interesting for your audience. And speaking mainly about Instagram, unfortunately, the platform is mainly concerned with the idea of the more the better today. I mean, in that sense, for instance, the algorithm favors people who dedicate their lives to the platform. That means posting every day, even twice, three times a day, appearing every day to talk to the audience on the Instagram stories. A mainly new trend that's being privileged is making short videos. I'm sure everyone knows about it, the Reels, which is similar to TikTok. It's something that Instagram made to compete with TikTok. And people who have Instagram as their primary source of work and income have to build strategies in this sense to reach their broader audience. However, that is unrealistic for us. Not only because we do our scientific divulgation entirely for free, which means that we do not receive any income from Instagram, but also because we don't have the resources to build an ad campaign or to invest funds to reach more people or even to hire people to think about specific content for each platform. But also that's not realistic for us because we elaborate content in our spare time, so to speak. I mean, as we said, we have research of our own. Anna is researching something for her master. I'm researching something for my PhD. Barbara is applying for graduate school and things like that. So we have to manage our time to write and to develop the contents we post on Instagram. That takes a lot of work. And that's also why we cannot grow our audience exponentially. I mean, we have been stuck with this number of 4,400 followers for time now, for months and months and months. So if you can follow us, please do. But that also brings to the points that Barbara has mentioned about staying true to our purpose, something I brought up earlier too. From the beginning, our goal was never to be famous or to produce easily understandable or shallow content or anyway, things like that. I mean, we do have an ethical commitment when we're posting about such a traumatic past as the Holocaust. And so our goal has always been a very simple one, to create ethical content about this topic and to spread this knowledge, especially spread this knowledge in Portuguese, because we don't have, like I said, many productions about this in our language. So it's very important for us to do that. And for this, we are very much aligned with the recent trend in social media that I don't know everyone is aware about, that's called slow content. In this process, the speed of the content is not the main goal, but the quality of the content, the quality of what's being posted. The slow content trend suits very well our scientific divulgation process because we have over time started posting less. And with that time that we managed, we could elaborate a better material. For instance, after slowing down, we created thematic content, like I said, thematic weeks, thematic months, and we could bring current trending topics. And we realized that staying eager to grow on Instagram requires nonstop work and a work that we cannot afford, not only in the financial sense, but also in the ethical sense. And one final point I would like to mention here today that is crucial for us to emphasize here that we are women producing content on the internet. And we are women who do not use our own image in doing that. As you can see, when I showed you our Instagram profile here, it is noticeable that there are no pictures of us there. There are no pictures of us. And the reason is the same as the ones that I just mentioned. I mean, we prioritize our content and we are very serious about what we write and what we post. But that is, of course, another challenge. I mean, after all, any major in digital marketing or any Instagram specialist will tell you that putting your face to the business is what guarantees our success. And we see other profiles that make much less serious content than ours, but they do it by posting pictures of themselves or by doing dances and, you know, giving into the current musics and things like that. And those people have much more followers than we do. They reach a broader audience, but we cannot do that. So to summarize what I just mentioned, I think we can say that we stopped worrying about the numbers of our followers and the number of likes we have in each post and started focusing more on this primary goal of producing unethical content. And I think that things got lighter after that.
Yes, well, that was really well said. And you touched upon very important aspects of what we're doing and of the difficulties that we're facing. But I would like to approach a different aspect of that, which is on how to reach people by making this content on Instagram about the Holocaust, about Nazis. And firstly, I think that it's important to signalize that since our work is based on scientific divulgation, most of the content is produced by the coordination of the nucleus. So, and also, well, by partner researchers. Still, even so, we always seek to hold dialogues with our followers, as we already mentioned, so that they can interact with the publications and see their personal issues being addressed in those publications. And a recent example of this dialogue is the post that we made in order to explain a mention of Adolf Eichmann's trial at the Parliamentary Inquiry Committee that was instituted to investigate alleged omissions and irregularities in the actions of the federal government of President Jair Bolsonaro during the pandemic here in Brazil. So in general lines, a Brazilian senator compared Eichmann and our former health minister, Eduardo Pazuello, pointing that similar to Eichmann, Pazuello claimed to simply follow orders from above and would have acted according to what he believed to be his duty, moved by the desire to rise in his professional career in the most perfect bureaucratic logic, and that he carried out orders without questioning them with the greatest zeal and efficiency without reflecting on the consequences that they might cause. This is the post Elmer is sharing with you guys. And well, this is unfortunately a lot as well. So yeah, well, but keep on going. So after this mention, many followers came to us questioning why this comparison was made and what it meant. So we decided to make a post and try to clarify a little bit of what was going on and why the senator has said that. And well, as you can see here, we adapted a Twitter trend that Maria made to Instagram format. As we already mentioned, we placed more pictures, we used the colors of our visual identity in order to make it more interesting for our Instagram followers. But this was a content that we also made in Twitter, as I just mentioned. So yeah, well, in this post, we seek to explain the references in the senator's speech, since in order to understand the parallel that he created, it was necessary to return to the philosopher Hannah Arendt and to her concept of banality of evil, that there she is. And in her book, Eichmann in Jerusalem, a report on banality of evil, she argued that Eichmann was simply a gear thief of Nazi bureaucracy, an ordinary man, but indispensable to the regime's functionality, that he carried out orders without thinking about them. And because of that, he represented the banality of evil, which is the absence of thought and judgment that can cause a mediocre individual such as Eichmann, and well, in our case, such as Pazuello, to commit crimes of enormous proportions without feeling guilty. Therefore, by carrying out the task of communicating this knowledge and putting it in dialogue with the demands of the subjects that were around us, we were able to transform this academic knowledge about Adolf Eichmann's trial and about the banality of evil into a tool for understanding the world around us. And well, our followers were able to understand the references, and now they can also use them whenever they need to make sense of, for example, what our politicians are saying. So as you can see here, it is possible to bring to Instagram with depth and commitment the academic readings that we do in our researches. And we also can encourage dialogue with our audience and help our followers to have a greater contact with this content that they wouldn't know otherwise, right? They're not specialists, they're not historians. So that I think that this is a good example that shows how we're trying to reach those people, how we're trying to bring those matters, those questions that reach us from the present and that they were there on the past, and trying to make sense of all of that kind of together. So I would just like to wrap up that. And I think that that goes to another direction of Barbara's question there in the beginning.
Thank you, Anna. Thank you, Maria. I think you gave excellent answers to my question. Do either of you want to make any last comments about the topics we discussed? Otherwise, I think we're reaching the end of the time for the roundtable discussions, and I'd really like to, all three of us, I'm sure, would like to open to receive questions from the audience. So I'm going to conclude. Both of you don't mind. Anna, I'd like to jump off a point made by Anna, which was how we respond to demands that come from the audience to us. And unfortunately, as a Brazilian living in present times, I think I will have to end on somewhat of a more depressing note, but I think we definitely saw a rise in curiosity about our work on social media and our research due to the recent growth of neo-Nazi groups, neo-Nazi manifestations in Brazil in the last few years. Obviously, this correlates to Jair Bolsonaro's presidency because he has indicated his support for the far right since the beginning of his political career, and now his connections with neo-Nazi groups are becoming more and more transparent. So that is unfortunately the context we are living in here in Brazil, and these historical connections between Brazil and the Nazi movement are very far-reaching. They have deep roots, but they are becoming more and more apparent. And so people are becoming more curious to learn about this, to seek information about this, and they have demanded that we keep talking about current events, and they have demanded historical analysis of the situations caused by the government and all of the political context here. There's also I think one thing we always say among the three of us is that we truly wish that our work wasn't so current, wasn't so relevant, because at times like this, it feels like we might as well just be studying the present. It sometimes feels like we aren't working as historians, but that is very unfortunate. But on the other hand, I do think that we are very glad to be able to do something and to respond to the public's demand for responsible historical analysis, however we can. Time has placed a very heavy burden upon us, but at least we can try to respond to that as best we can as historians. So I think I'd like to conclude the roundtable discussion just by saying that.
Bom, gente, então hoje nós ficamos por aqui. A gente espera que vocês tenham gostado da nossa mesa redonda. E no mais, a gente se vê no próximo episódio. Beijo, tchau!